You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm really looking forward to today's show. My guest is Tim Bartik, who's a senior economist with the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. This is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research institute up in the state of Michigan, here in the Midwest. And the topic we're going to talk about here is very timely. In the broader sense, we're going to talk about the economy and jobs, which is going to be a major issue in this campaign. But more specifically, I want to look at some things that are happening in the realm of assistance to governments and local communities as far as what they can do to nurture their economies. It seems to me like, and I'll ask Tim this starting right off, Tim, welcome. It seems like we're on the cusp of an important moment here where, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we're kind of getting better at knowing what works and what doesn't. And hopefully the programs are going to kind of start taking shape more along those lines.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that, you know, jobs are very important. I mean, and although the national economy overall, I think, is doing pretty well in terms of jobs right now, there obviously are parts of the country, certain local labor markets, certain metro areas, obviously certain rural areas where jobs are lacking. And then, of course, even if the overall metro area economy is doing well, there are certain neighborhoods where jobs are lacking. And, you know, the issue is jobs are very valuable, but if it costs you too much to create them, you know, if the economic development incentives are too costly per job created, then even if jobs are really valuable, very beneficial, maybe it's not a good idea to pursue them. And, you know, what I've argued over the years, though, business tax incentives, which is the main thing that state and local economic development agencies use to attract jobs, can work. They can be quite costly per job created. And there are other policies that are less costly. And my other policies, rather than making that mysterious, what I mean by that is that various customized services to business can be more effective. I mean, so what's more effective? One thing that's more effective is simply making business sites more readily available, making sure you have land that's zoned for business that has the requisite infrastructure, including roads, to make that site a viable site. That can be much more effective than simply handing out cash via business tax incentives. Another thing that'd be more effective is customized job training, where you have a local community college. I don't know if that's the term used in Iowa and Illinois for these things, but they've gone into various terminology around the country. Local community colleges where they work with an individual business and say, well, what kind of workers do you need? We'll help screen and train the workers. That can be very effective in helping encourage the business to expand. And finally, business advice programs of various sorts. I mean, there are manufacturing extension programs around the country that target manufacturing and work with small and medium-sized manufacturers and saying, well, here are some new technologies that might help you make you more competitive. Or they'll help to move in the new markets. So, you know, maybe a manufacturer has been an auto supplier and they've been bending metal or molding plastic for auto companies. And, you know, maybe they want to transition into bending metal and molding plastic for medical instruments, which is a different market. You know, you can help them move into that. There are also business advice programs like small business development centers that can be quite effective. If business advice is relatively cheap to provide, but if it's good advice, it can really translate into increased jobs. So I've argued that we should think about economic development programs more broadly than simply handing out cash. Handing out cash is easy, but maybe too easy sometimes.
Yeah, I would agree. So we've set the foundation here. Let's unwrap some of this. I came across your name here just last week. You've done some excellent research. And I would encourage listeners right now, let me get this done. Upjohn.org, UPJOHN.org. Find Tim and look at some of the work he's done. It's very relevant to our area, the listening area, and also Rock Island and Scott counties. But I came across your name writing about distressed communities. And my immediate thought was, based on the economic history of here, I thought, well, I wonder if Rock Island and Scott are in those. But talk about that a little bit, and kind of what the definition is, and how these communities are doing.
Well, obviously, there are different ways you can define distress. It's somewhat arbitrary. What I've tried to focus on as one indicator of distress, I mean, I'm not saying this is the only thing you want to look at, is the employment to population ratio for so-called, what economists sometimes call prime age workers. Now, what are prime age workers? People ages 25 to 54. Why do you want to look at that group? Well, you wouldn't want to say an area is distressed just because it has a lot of retirees or a lot of college students, both of whom tend to have somewhat lower employment rates than is true for 25 to 54-year-olds. I mean, so you wouldn't want to say that. So you want to somewhat control for age mix. And looking at 25 to 54-year-olds kind of does that. And that's a group that generally we would expect to be employed, or most people in that category to be employed. And when you look at that particular measure of a local economy, you do find it's very correlated with a lot of things. Areas that have a low prime age employment rate tend to have higher substance abuse, higher crime, higher rate of family breakups. And in fact, you find that if a community has a low prime age employment rate, if a neighborhood has a low prime age employment rate, that children growing up in that neighborhood 20 or 30 years later tend to have lower adult earnings. And why is that? Well, I mean, a variety of reasons. The neighborhood tends to have higher crime, higher substance abuse. There were fewer adult role models who were working. When people got to be teenagers, they don't have the job networks. I mean, frequently people get jobs when they're young by knowing people who know about job openings. So there are a variety of reasons why a prime age employment rate might be correlated with many other measures of economic distress. Now, in terms of your area and looking at Scott County and Rock Island County, the overall counties, the prime age employment rate is quite good. It's above the national average, and has been for a while. I think it'd be hard to argue that the overall county, in terms of the prime age employment rate, is distressed. That doesn't mean there aren't neighborhoods that are distressed. I mean, I'm not familiar with all the neighborhoods, but simply looking at the data, there are census tracts that have very low prime age employment rates. And of course, it's also not maybe the case that other parts of both, obviously, there are many rural areas and outside of these counties that frequently have lower employment rates. And that's a challenge. I mean, you simply, you want to have a society where most people from 25 to 54 can get a job and can get a halfway decent job that can help support them and their family.
It seems like in our area, and you're aware of this in the Midwest, but especially in our area as well, we a lot of places were heavily dependent on manufacturing, and of course that's been that's declined to say the least, and in a lot of these counties, and incomes have dropped as well. And you still have these debates, and I'm somebody who's worked in local economic development around here, where people still want to go get the big factory in place of doing other maybe little things. They're going, in baseball parlance, they're going for the home run rather than just a base hit and moving the guy along. Do you still see a lot of that? And I know Michigan's getting some investment in battery factories, things like that. But overall, if you were going to talk to somebody that's been traditionally dependent on manufacturing, what would your advice be to kind of try to build on that or look elsewhere?
Well, I think it varies from place to place. I'm someone who doesn't believe that there's a one-size-fits-all answer in economic development. Every area is different. I mean, for example, in near where I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan, And so about an hour north of Kalamazoo is Grand Rapids, Michigan. Grand Rapids, Michigan is arguably the most successful manufacturing intensive community in the country. I mean, it has about double the national average of share of jobs in manufacturing. And they've had manufacturing job growth over the past 30 years. They have a lot of small and medium-sized manufacturers, obviously in the office furniture industry is one well-known area, but they have some auto suppliers and they have people in healthcare and medical instruments. They have some auto suppliers who have switched. I mentioned this before. They have auto suppliers who have switched to doing from doing auto supply to doing things in the healthcare area. I guess my view is, I don't think, okay, so is manufacturing going to be the main source of job growth in the U.S. in the future? No. Why not? Well, you know, because in fact, there's been quite a lot of productivity growth in manufacturing and, you know, robots are moving in. So you don't need as many people to produce things that you once did. On the other hand, is manufacturing going to do as badly as it did in the period from 2000 to, for at least the next decade after that, 2010, manufacturing did terrible. We had the so-called China shock for a variety of reasons due to public policy. There was a big increase in imports from China. A lot of manufacturing was very adversely affected in the U.S., a lot of political reaction to that. That's not going to continue. For obvious political reasons, the U.S. Is not going to continue to allow for that. Also, for national security reasons, we're trying to do more domestic sourcing of various defense-related products. And then more broadly, we want to, you know, the CHIPS Act, we want to domestically source more semiconductors and a variety of other manufacturing that for national security grounds, we're going to want to maintain a presence in. So I think that there is going to be, you know, manufacturing jobs, I think overall will decline as a percent of the labor force, as a percent of workers. But I think, you know, we're likely to see manufacturing jobs overall in the U.S. probably stay roughly static over the next 10 to 20 years. So what does that mean for individual areas? Well, I mean, if you're an area you feel you can be competitive manufacturing, you know, you should be seeing if you can maintain your manufacturing jobs, maybe shift some of the industries they're in. But you also, of course, have to explore other areas. Obviously, there are various high-tech industries and software that are not manufacturing related that you can think about. There are obviously healthcare is an area. And of course, you know, tourism and things like that. Or, I mean, there are many economic strategies. I mean, some areas will be able to do well by attracting retirees. In fact, there could be a strategy based on you want to invest in amenities so you can attract some combination of remote workers and retirees in industries. I mean, I don't think, although remote work, you know, there's some attempt now by various businesses to get remote workers to come back in the office. But I do think remote work at a higher percentage is here to stay. I mean, workers like it. And I think businesses are having to adjust to what workers' preferences are.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm really enjoying my conversation so far with Tim Bartek, my guest this week. He's a senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, located in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan research firm. He does a lot of work on place-based economic policies and economic development. He's written a lot recently, and a lot of this, I think, is very, very relevant to our region. We've been talking a little bit about distressed communities and about a little bit about manufacturing because of the manufacturing heritage here in our region and up in Michigan. I want to talk about a program that started right there in Kalamazoo called the Kalamazoo Promise. I was reading about this back when it was first passed. For our listeners, I might have you describe what it is. I know that some communities in our region have tried this. Davenport, Iowa, tried to pass, I believe, some type of sales tax increase to fund it, and it failed. Peoria, Illinois, has a version of this, all privately funded. Galesburg has, I believe, a hotel motel tax devoted to it for scholarships for kids to go to the area junior college. But talk about what it is and what it when it was implemented, you've had a lot of time to research this. Has this really achieved its aims and helped promote growth in Kalamazoo? So if you could kind of discuss all that at length, that would be great.
Well, the Kalamazoo Promise was started in 2005. It's a pretty straightforward program. Anonymous private donors agreed that they would, in perpetuity, it's intended to be permanent, provide up to a four-year college scholarship at 100% of tuition initially for any public university or community college, or for that matter, many apprenticeship programs in Michigan. And then a few years back, it was extended. A group of private colleges in Michigan agreed that they would participate in the program as well and keep their tuition rates to a certain level to accommodate that. So basically, you get 100% up to 100%. There was a sliding scale based on how long you've been in Kalamazoo Public Schools. It's a Kalamazoo Public Schools or anything. Graduates of Kalamazoo Public Schools, if you started in ninth grade, you get 65% of tuition. If you started in kindergarten, you get 100%. If you started after, they didn't want people coming in senior year and just taking it. So you have to start at least in ninth grade. As I said, it started in 2005. I actually was president of the Kalamazoo School Board that year. So I'm very familiar with the program. I stepped off the board in 2008. And at the Upjohn Institute, we've done extensive studies of the Kalamazoo Promise. And for that matter, we've been really part of trying to study this program around the country. I co-direct something on place-based policy at the Institute with my colleagues, Brad Hirschbein and Michelle Miller Adams. And both Brad and Michelle, as well as me, have done a lot of studies, not just the Kalamazoo Promise, but of promise programs around the country. In fact, if you go to our website, you can find a whole database we have on so-called promise programs around the country, place-based scholarships. What we found from the studies is they definitely do significantly increase not only enrollment at colleges, but graduation rates. In the case of the Kalamazoo Promise, it increased successful attainment of either an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree or some other post-secondary credential by one-third as of 6 years after high school graduation. And that's based on comparing eligible students with ineligible students, because some students in Kalamazoo Public Schools aren't eligible because they started after ninth grade. Now, you know, the glass is either half empty or half full. By saying it went up by one-third, attainment of a post-secondary credential went up from 36% to 48% of all students. So the glass is half full. It went up by a third, 36 to 48%. And when you look at that and you project what the lifetime increase in earnings is from getting that post-secondary credential, the benefits of this program and on any kind of benefit cost study vastly exceed the cost. Even if this wasn't private donors, you could say the economic benefits would exceed the cost of the government paying for this. On the other hand, obviously, you're giving a free ride to college, and yet it's the case that half of all the kids, at least within a six-year period, and you have up to 10 years to use this, so some of the kids who don't get it within 6 years will get it within 10 years, but still half the kids do not get any kind of post-secondary credential within 6 years. And why is that? Because, some of the kids don't, even though they graduate high school, may not have the skills, or there may be problems in their families, and, you know, there are a variety of reasons. So, you know, it's not like giving free college to kids solves all the problems of poverty. It doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some kids who are able to use this and they successfully get a credential and they're able to get better jobs. Other kids, they have other issues going on. And, it's like most things, there's not one solution to problems. I mean, everyone looking for some magic solution that solves all the problems. There isn't one solution. So the Kalamazoo Promise, I think, in place-based scholarships in general, and furthermore, it does promote the economy. I mean, I think there's some evidence of that. We did one study looking at this. There's enrollment in Kalamazoo Public Schools surged after this, which brought in a lot of state aid. The real estate companies were advertising their properties were in Kalamazoo Public School District, which was not going on before because Kalamazoo Public Schools is, you know, like 70% of the kids are eligible for reduced price lunch. So it wasn't like before they were advertising properties saying Kalamazoo Promise eligible. So it attracted, it helped retain a lot of families. And one of the things you find in the studies of these kind of promise programs is it looks like out-migration rates of people, particularly those with kids, really go down. So what happens is your area becomes stickier in terms of people, that essentially a lot of people say, well, look, we're living in this community. If we stay here and keep our kid in the schools, they will get this benefit, which is really good for our family, good for them. They don't have this huge student debt. And so you are able to retain a lot of kids, and it attracts, I mean, a wide range of kids. So, I mean, this was something we found, that exit rates for Black students went down, for white students went down, for Hispanic students went down, every, you know, low-income kids went down, middle-class kids went down. All these groups, basically people said, well, look, we really want to use this program. We're going to stay with the public schools and be loyal to it. And we'll see if we, you know, we'll if we're unhappy with our kids teacher or principal, we'll see if we can fix the problem by getting a different teacher or by moving to a different school. We're not going to just exit the system and move somewhere else.
It's a really interesting program. And again, the fact that a lot of places in this region too are aware of it and have tried to replicate it makes it interesting and worth following. And again, for our listeners, if you want to learn more, go to this website, upjohn.org. And find out more of Tim's research. I want to kind of close here in our last, we've got about 4 minutes here. As I said in the opening, some of these programs, and the one in particular I thought was interesting is the Recompete program. And you referenced this, where it's a different approach to economic development. I want you to talk about that and why it's so important. I'm really hoping they can expand this at some point, but talk about it and why it's different and why it's important.
Well, the Recompete program was a program authorized by Congress as part of the CHIPS Act, and it came out of actually a proposal I made in a policy brief that was picked up by a congressman from the state of Washington, Derek Kilmer, and he put in a bill. And the original bill was for a program that would really try to bring up all the distressed places in the U.S. at a cost of about $15, $20 billion a year for about 10 years. But what he got to the CHIPS Act was a much smaller program. It's really a pilot program. And the basic idea is to say that distressed areas, and it can be distressed local labor market, or it can be distressed neighborhood that the city is trying to redevelop, we want you to come up with a strategy for getting more people into jobs. It could be bringing in jobs through economic development programs of various sort, you know, these various business services I mentioned, or it could be something where we try to get people into jobs through job training, job placement. We get people a reliable used car. We make sure they have access to childcare. We have job success coaches who can help overcome retention problems that people might have. And we'll do whatever we can to get people into jobs, either through working with business to expand jobs or working with people to help people access and retain jobs. And the idea is that what you need in different areas is different. So the federal government, rather than saying, well, we know everything, we're going to set up exactly this program, here are all the program rules, we're instead going to fund creative local strategies. It's kind of a more of a less of a top-down federal approach and more of a let 100 flowers bloom. Let's have see creative local solutions to problems, and we'll fund a variety of things. They just announced the six grantees for Recompete the other day through the Economic Development Administration, and this got more applications than just about anything EDA, the Economic Development Administration, has ever done. They got 565 applications. They ended up only being able to provide six grants. And, you know, what I've said is I hope the federal government expands this in the future. We'll see. And I hope state governments do this. There's no reason why either state governments or wealthy foundations like the Gates Foundation or local foundations couldn't fund some of this. In other words, let's recognize that jobs are really important. Getting people into jobs is really important. And let's focus in on both job creation and job training and job retention strategies that can do that. Because I don't think that, I think that there are things you can do to increase the number of people in good jobs, and they're worth doing. It's worth spending some money to do it.
I do have a couple minutes left. I'm going to throw one more topic in. We've hopped around here, but there's so much you're doing here that I wanted to share with our listeners. And this is on our early childhood education. Everybody talks about the benefit of this from a human perspective. You talk about the benefit for businesses. If you could, in under 2 minutes, encapsulate that.
Well, what I've argued is the kind of the, you know, I've given a lot of talks in the business case for economic development and for early childhood, which is what do early childhood programs do? Well, you know, if they're high quality preschool program, you know, at age four or even at age three, what they've shown in studies is that as adults, a higher percentage of these people are able to go on to complete high school and get go to college and be available for work and be working rather than being involved with crime or other problems. And so from the point of view of economic development, what this does is add to the effective labor supply, not only in the nation, but in the local area, because Americans aren't as hypermobile as people think. A lot of people that if a state invests in early childhood, yes, some people will leave the state, but a lot of people do stick around. People have ties to family and places, and you will, in fact, get a lot of more people in the local economy who are more readily employable. And that has enormous benefits for the business. It's better able to hire people, and it has spillover benefits for everyone else. There's a lot of evidence that the skills of your peers. I mean, if you just think about it, if you have a lot of skills, but all your coworkers don't have skills, it's more difficult for your employer to introduce new technologies. So so one question always has is, why should you care what are the skills of other people's children? Why should I, as a taxpayer, pay higher taxes to help other people's children get better skills? What's in it for me? If you know, it's a nice thing to do, but what's in it for me? What's in it for you is, even if you think your kid will be fine without preschool, you may benefit from having all the kids have higher quality preschool, and for that matter, higher quality K-12. Because having more skills of everyone in a local economy enables local business to be more competitive. They can find workers who can adapt to new technologies better, and that's going to help you in the long term. Even if you individually feel you'd be fine without it, you will actually find your wages brought up because the overall business community will be more competitive. So, and again, if you want to see more on this, I've written a lot about this. And in fact, I have a TED talk about this that I think is probably my most famous thing that's, I think it's been viewed like 500,000 times. I even did a thing for Detroit Public TV once, you can find somewhere, where I have a series of talks on the economic benefits of early childhood, little 1.5 minute things that Detroit Public TV did one year.
Well, this has been a really good conversation, and I appreciate your time. My guest today has been Tim Bartik, who's the senior economist with the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization up in Michigan. Tim, thank you very much. I know we kind of whiplashed around to a lot of different topics, but I just wanted to touch on a lot of things a little bit. And if people are interested in more, they can go to the website. Thank you again for being my guest today on Heartland Politics.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at wvik.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.